Greetings, everybody, and welcome once again to the Zelda Universe Podcast. We are grateful to have you join us and reminisce once again about our many adventures and experiences in the lands of Hyrule and beyond. My name is Connor Schultz. I am happy to be here once again with you. And joining me today, we have Caden.
I am also, as always, happy to be here. It's always a pleasure.
And Jeff, I don't know, when's the last time you've been here?
It's been a little while. I think it was right before Echoes of Wisdom came out.
Oh gosh, it's been a hot minute. So welcome to the new version of the podcast. As we highlight the excellent work that our many writers contribute to the Zelda Universe website and community. And of course, that is the reason why Jeff is here. We'll be getting to his article a little bit later on. But we're going to start today with Zelda Study, the series in which we examine the history of The Legend of Zelda to bring you fascinating or just plain weird trivia, focusing on development, curiosities, and the impact it has had on our culture. And today, we are looking at a side quest based in Wind Waker, and it's one of those quests that is very easy to miss. One of the interesting things about The Legend of Zelda is that a lot of the side quests that you can run into are ones that if you're not paying attention, and if you're not just exploring, but exploring multiple times, you will miss stuff. I've been interested in examples of this in Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom because it's a lot easier to stumble into these things that are happening that don't necessarily have a mini quest marker. But it's a lot easier to have these kinds of situations when you don't have mini quest titles and things. It's just, oh, I just happen to be walking around and, huh, you're new. You weren't here the last time I was here. How long did it take you guys to discover the change in fortunes with Maggie, her father, and then, oh gosh, I can't remember the other two.
I honestly forgot most characters' names in Wind Waker that aren't like main like cutscene related characters. But I know the characters who you're talking about. I just forgot their names.
Wasn't Wind Waker really like the first Zelda game to give a unique name to pretty much every NPC?
Majora's Mask.
Well, no, but like there are people in Majora's Mask and like say Clocked Out who don't have a name. Like not part of a side quest, but like literally every NPC in the Wind Waker has a name that you can find in like a player's guide or in like the official manuals. Like they're not necessarily the ones that are part of a side quest, but I think Wind Waker was the first in the series to do that. Like, even ones who are completely insignificant have a name.
Yeah, maybe, actually.
It's quite possible. Wind Waker, I said, our newer games give you the title
right
of the person speaking in the top left corner of their little speech box. You don't have that in Wind Waker, but there are enough conversations happening between people, and they tend to be using their names in one form or another. I don't know if it's every single one of them, but it's nearly every single one of them.
Right. I think so. Like even I don't know the names. I'm pretty sure like the guy that's dancing in front of that grave that gives you the
Elvis dude.
Yes, he's dancing. He has a name.
He does. I don't remember it either off the top of my head, but
man, what kind of Zelda enthusiasts are we? We can't remember NPC number 57263.
But like even the most, you know, generic looking Rito will have a name, like a unique name, I think, on Dragon Roost Isle. And right. I know all of the Koroks have unique names. So, but like you wouldn't have seen that with, say, every single Deku in Majora's Mask. The important one, sure, like you know, the butler has a title and then the princess.
Actually, they don't even have names.
Or like, I mean, like they have a title, but that's what I mean. Like they have a type, they have an identity, I guess is the better way to put it.
Right. Like in Majora's Mask, like the windmill guy, the music box guy. I think his name in Majora's Mask is Guru.
Correct.
Yes.
And you have like Kamaro and stuff, but I think the bombers, the kids, don't have names.
I don't think so either. Or the one maybe.
Yeah, just the boss has a name. I forget. We all forget names.
And so like names. The astronomer at the observatory. I don't think he has a name, right?
Yeah.
But like that's what I'm saying. Like not every single NPC has an actual name. Whereas I think Wind Waker did that for just about every single NPC in the overworld.
I want to say yeah. I want to say yes. There's probably a few that slip through the cracks, but...
Right.
Yeah. But there's a lot. And certainly enough that now that we have a whole different section, we'll get to the Bomber's Notebook later, that we can just spend forever talking about different NPCs and what they do, and is there anything significant about them. And the nice thing about how Zelda games tend to be formulated is that most of them have a significant role in what you are doing. Even though you want to have enough NPCs floating around to give the illusion that this is an actual functioning society, there's still enough flavor happening for you to start relating to, oh no, this is actual Tim who does this thing, and here's Sandra over here who does this thing. It's fun to have that kind of personability. That's not a word.
we get what you're saying, though.
Like, yes. They're personable. It's personable. There's a little bit more of a connection, especially when you can see changes in NPC development over time, as opposed to just, I am here to sell you goods. That's all I do. I am NPC store man. While here, we have a story of rags to riches and riches to rags. A pair of girls who start on economic ends and end up flipping. How you get a bottle is through one of them. While Maggie doesn't really have anything specific that you actually get from her, really. I think some money at the end is about it.
Joy pendant?
It might be a joy pendant. Either way, it's not exactly significant.
Right, it's not a major quest item or anything. Not like the bottle is.
No, and yet it's a lot more involved. As we have this kind of Beauty and the Beast setup, sort of. Except the Beast is a literal moblin who wants to eat her. And Maggie does not get it at all. It's very awkward.
Yeah.
No, it's a really good example of some of the subtle dark humor that Zelda games, or really Nintendo games in general, often slip in.
How did that relationship? It's a one-sided relationship. First off, I'm just impressed that Mo the Moblin can even spell. So props for him in understanding that.
Let alone manage the postal services. Or
oh gosh, have you talked? Do you ever talk to the postman who tries? No, you have to. When you talk to the postman, when her father rejects the letter because he doesn't want anybody getting with his dear Maggie. The postman's like, dude, do you have any idea the hell I went through just to deliver these letters? The Forsaken Fortress?
Oh, man. I do not envy
that postman deserves a commendation.
I do find it interesting that Mo, I'm sure, I'm just blanking, but I'm pretty sure Mo is probably one of the most sophisticated monsters in the series, like that are like a moblin, not like a specific group of enemies that are also like sentient, like the River Zoras or something like that, but like a moblin, like classic monster. This is probably the most
civilized and
yeah, well developed, I guess.
Educated.
I'd say the two monsters that I would say top the list of most sophistication, we have Batro from Skyward Sword, who literally wants to become a human. And he is very civilized. Anytime I'm playing Skyward Sword, I always voice him as having the most proper British accent because that's the height of sophistication I attach to him. And then the second one is the Bokoblin boss in Twilight Princess. I forget
King Boblin.
Those are Boblins.
Yeah. Like, when Vin is like, it talked.
It talked.
Huh.
As a kid, I always thought, because they have like a base in the Gerudo Desert, and I hadn't played a lot of Zelda games at that point, I thought they were the Gerudo. I was like,
no.
Oh, it's the Gerudo.
Oh, no.
Keep in mind, I was like 8 when I played Twilight Princess. So I had no idea. Then I played more games. Oh, okay. They're not the Gerudo. But I was really confused. But even now, I still kind of just associate the Boblins as just being a separate organization of, like, creatures that are just conscripted into the Zant's army, I guess. Or Ganondorf's army.
Yeah, it's... You try and get into the origins of monsters in Zelda, and you get a whole lot of conflicting origin stories.
Yeah. I'll stick with my headcanon. they're the Gerudo, but they got transformed. That's where the Gerudo went.
They were Gerudo once. Taken by the dark forces.
Yeah.
Tortured, twisted, and now perfect. Xantus Saruman confirmed.
And they also ride pigs now.
Does that mean they eat moblins? Because moblins are pigs.
I mean, there's no moblins in Twilight Princess, so maybe that's where they all went. Maybe that's why.
Just start going down the evolutionary line of moblins.
I need a whole video essay about moblin lore.
Oh, no. I'm sure it exists somewhere.
I'm looking at a list of all NPCs in Wind Waker. And
it's a large list.
Yeah. It does appear that majority of them... There's obviously groups like the Killer Bees. I don't know if the Killer Bees, the kids, have names individually. They do, I think.
They do. They do.
They mention them in the quest.
They totally do.
But the other girl... The rich turned poor girl is Mila.
There we go.
Why does that not ring a bell? Huh. I'm just that bad with names, I guess.
Yeah, I don't have these. The Rito names, never heard of these in my life.
Right, because they, back then, they weren't putting the NPC's name above their speech bubble. So, like, the only way you would find these is if you had, like, the official Prima player's guide, or if you went online and went to GameFAQs.
Right.
Good times. When you had to find information.
Yeah, you had to find stuff. And back when physical player's guides were prominent.
I treasured my player guides.
Me too. I always
those things.
I keep them preserved on my bookshelf.
I have a story about player's guides that have nothing to do with Wind Waker, so I'll leave it for... Basically, the Ocarina of Time player's guide spoiled me on everything in Ocarina of Time before I had a chance to play it, because my brother was playing it first, and so I stopped player's guides after that, essentially.
That's fair.
Well, thank you to Aaron Talon for giving us this fun tidbit to look at in Zelda's study. And we move on to the Realm of Memories, the series where we reflect on our absolute favorite moments in the Legend of Zelda games. And we are heading down into Ocarina of Time, and being reminded once again that holy crap, these games were terrifying. And yet they're somehow rated E for everyone.
Yeah. It's especially with the PAL version of Ocarina of Time, where the blood wasn't censored and it was actually blood.
It's the gold cartridge, and I think the very first version of the gray cartridge in North America have red blood.
Yeah.
And I think I played Ocarina of Time first on the GameCube with the Master Quest on the disc.
Yeah,
ah.
That wouldn't have the red blood. They would have already changed it by then.
Okay.
Yeah, it was only the very first printing of the gray cartridges that still had the red blood, still had the original Fire Temple music, the star encrusted symbol for the Gerudo.
Right.
I believe that all got changed in the second printing of the gray cartridges.
Yes.
And Ganondorf coughing up the red blood, too.
Yep.
Yep. Good times. Good times. Specifically for the Realm of Memories today, we are looking at the cemetery areas of Kakariko Village. So we're looking at the tomb of the Composer Brothers. We're looking at the other assorted tombs that are hanging out there, the bottom of the well, and more infamously, the Shadow Temple. And there are bones everywhere in this place. Some of them, not human bones, but most of them most certainly supposed to be human bones. The walls are lined with them. It's like they took every single bone of every person who's ever died and said, yes, that's what we are designing our walls around.
It is.
How did Nintendo get away with this stuff? Or better yet, why can't they get away with this stuff nowadays? We need more fantasy darkness.
Yeah, there's definitely been a shift, and I don't know exactly if you could pinpoint the exact moment in time when it happened, but where Zelda's like tone kind of softened a bit, and they really steered away from those edgier and like almost like dark fantasy or horror elements that were not super common, but would occasionally pop up in Zelda, whether that was Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask, Twilight Princess had some elements of it, but even Twilight Princess kind of feels like it leans more into tragedy than horror or dark fantasy.
I would imagine there's something to do with the decision to go with super, I don't know how to like describe it, but like super inspired art design and art styles.
So we're blaming Wind Waker?
Wind Waker. But even like the watercolor splash art style of Skyward Sword, and then like the Ghibli like style for the Wild Games. It's all very specific and intentional and really well made. But I feel like Zelda could use somewhat of like a let's make things dark and sharp edges, and I feel like that'd be really cool, especially now.
Oh yeah, like just compare the official art from Ocarina of Time to the official art from Breath of the Wild, like two completely different tones and aesthetics.
Right.
I wonder then if a lot of that is just based on the hardware limitations of the time, because Ocarina of Time, the N64 games in general, particularly the early sets, yes, you could have a complete range of games like you can with anything between like Mario is a lot more happy, whimsical compared to Ocarina of Time. But still, that blocky texture that they had to work with those first ever three-dimensional graphics doesn't really allow for too much variance, or at least minutia, in how you bring this stuff across. So when the Western, the states and etc. were like, saw Ocarina of Time, they're thinking high fantasy type of stuff and felt completely blindsided by Wind Waker, that might have just been a hardware limitations that was part of that issue. this is all they could work with. And so this is what they created because it fit with what they were working with.
Like, how much of a unique art direction can you feasibly put into the 64-bit graphics? Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And I honestly, it might even be, I think a factor of that could be because of those limitations that limited how detailed some of the more dark elements could be portrayed to anyone that's giving it a age rating or anything like that. Like, there is, like, Dead Hand, for example, has a lot of red blotchiness. And in retrospect, I can, or even back then, you can see how it might be like, oh, blood and gore and stuff. But with the advancements of technology, if you were to take Dead Hand out of Ocarina of Time, put him into, even into Skyward Sword or anything, any other game, it would be much clearer.
Right.
Based like in any modern game with the graphical fidelity we have nowadays.
That's where you get where in Ocarina of Time, if you're hitting an enemy with your sword, you see the like the splashes of animated blood. Whereas, you know, with Breath of the Wild or Tears of the Kingdom, for example, you just see like flashes of light. And it's almost like you're striking a solid, like a statue, as opposed to a living flesh-based object. Mm-hmm.
So you're telling me that we're not going to be getting Resident Evil Zelda Edition?
Listen, you never know. But I'm gonna say if you're looking for gore and stuff like that, you're going to have to refer to the Twilight Princess manga.
Speaking of, quick aside, Twilight Princess manga is so peak.
Yes, it is.
Oh my goodness.
That's why I reviewed every single volume.
I'm collecting them. I have them on my bookshelf right now behind me.
Oh, it's easy. It's the best Zelda narrative in any medium.
It's so good.
Better than any of the stories from one of the games. Just a phenomenal adaptation and expansion of the story.
I love the amount of fan fiction that comes with this section of Ocarina of Time. There's so much hidden potential in the vagueness of these older games. Where did this place come from? What's going on? Which makes it a lot more open to interpretation as opposed to what we get in later games where there's a lot more, a clear explanation as to where most of these stuff comes from, even though we still have ancient temple from so long ago, yada yada type of situation. There's so little explanation as to what's actually going on in Ocarina of Time or Majora's Mask or anything like that, that allows people to just take this place. Oh my gosh, what is this undead abyss sitting underneath Hyrule? These vague lines of disembodied voice text, and let's run with it. I had a blast when I was trying to adapt the game into a more story format when I was playing this a year or so ago, trying to unearth, as so many people have tried to unearth, quote unquote, the dark past of Hyrule. This is the kind of stuff that just sparks the imagination.
Yeah, the theory crafting is really, it's honestly one of the biggest draws for me, especially as a modern Zelda fan. That's honestly why I find the timeline stuff so appealing. It's obviously, I love when the games themselves give you that world building and explaining and fleshing things out. But just leaving some empty gaps for the opportunity to theorycraft is honestly really appealing as well. It even happens with Twilight Princess, like the origins of Snowhead is Majora's Mask. Snow Peak is, there's a theory that the Snow Peak Ruins is where the royal knights went to train, because there's a bunch of royal knight memorabilia and regalia, armor sets and stuff like that. Or it could be a noble family. It could be a Shay's home, like family home. I think that's explained in the manga.
I don't think it's her home. She shows up there in the manga, but I don't think it's her home. I think it's mentioned that it was like a place of nobility or like an aristocrat's home or something like that.
Right. That's what I love about the series in general, is that like there's so much opportunity for theory crafting and like headcanons, world building in your mind, and you're able to take those elements and run with them. It's really cool.
That's one of the fun things about, I think, just video game design. Because when you have a book, for example, particularly if you're familiar with a lot of science fiction or fantasy writing, they tend to explain the purpose and the reason for anything that they come across. And there's a particular purpose why they have traveled to such and such a place, or why such and such a place exists. Because you kind of have to literally spell things out for your readers as to what's going on to help you form that kind of mental picture of, this is why this temple is here, this is why we have come to this place, so you can get a clear idea of what's going on. While with video games, you don't have to say it, you just show it. But since you don't have to say it, you don't have to explain anything, which means everything is suddenly open to interpretation.
And you can fill in the gaps.
Caden, I must apologize. You were correct. I actually just checked my copy of Volume 6 from the Twilight Princess manga, and Ashe does confirm that it was her house, and that her father was a knight, and he taught her how to fight while she lived there.
That's so cool. And honestly, right? The Twilight Princess manga is basically this entire concept. Like, the writers fill in gaps in the story. It's not canon or anything like that, but they take the opportunity with this new medium to give backstories to characters, make new characters to fill in the gaps. It's so cool. I love manga so much.
That's the funnest thing about being able to do that. It's okay, here's the story that has been given to us. How can we flesh it out just a little bit more to make things flow, to make things make a little bit more sense, to compensate for the fact that when you are playing, there's a different experience than if you are being a storyteller, which is really fun to be able to do. Well, thank you to Briar Washerbaugh for letting us peek into this section of the Realm of Memories. We move over to the Bomber's Notebook, the series where we take a special look at the various and unique characters found in the Legend of Zelda series. And for today, we are moving over to Breath of the Wild. And we've talked a little bit already about NPCs just going about their lives and having things happen to them. And today we are looking at a young Hylian named Lika, who, the first time you ever run into her, she's getting attacked. So, trying to look back into your memories now that it's been 8 years. First time you ever ran into Lika, were you able to save her? Or was she knocked out the first time on that bridge she is accosted by moblins?
The first time? That was a while ago.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you for sure.
I'm just going to say yes. I saved her.
I don't think I did. It's still early. You're still wandering around, trying to figure out what the heck's going on. Oh, what's going on? What's going over there? What's it? Uh-oh.
Oh, she's
wait,
she's
that's gone. That's a call for help bubble. Because this is not one of those designated cutscene events or specified side quests. It's just, we're going around, we're looking at stuff, and then suddenly two things come together and someone's getting attacked. It's like that adventuring brother and sister duo. I think it's brother and sister, where the girl is all ready for adventures and whatnot, and the guy is like, I'm just doing this because she keeps going crazy. She keeps traveling places, and I don't want her to die. And why are we out here? Here, have some food as thanks. Are the two girls looking for mushrooms?
I was actually really going to bring that up. I think they're right outside Hateno Village.
Yes.
And every time I go to Hateno Village, I just check if they're there, and they usually are. And they sometimes get attacked by bokoblins. So I'm like, oh, gotta save you guys. Get some mushrooms. But that's what I love about this game, is that there's there's like NPCs have their own routines, and Majora's Mask did this as well, obviously. But Breath of the Wild and now Tears of the Kingdom does it on like a bigger scale. And I enjoy that these NPCs have their own stuff going on, whether it's being attacked or just doing some gathering, usually being attacked.
I just remember one of those earliest Breath of the Wild trailers. It may have been the Life in Ruins trailer where they first showed off a couple of the NPCs fighting bokoblins. And like, it was just that 1 second out of a fairly long trailer that a lot of fans went crazy for, because we really hadn't seen NPCs interacting with monsters on such an organic level at that point in the series yet. Like that was an example of how we felt that Breath of the Wild was really expanding the scope and the scale of Zelda games.
Right. I had forgotten about that.
Was that a Game Awards trailer? I can't remember when that one released. I mean, obviously that's even longer ago than the game's release. So you're pushing 8-9 years for that.
Oh, I still remember when they first announced Breath of the Wild and the Switch, because it was the same live stream. I was working.
The one that was airing from Japan, right?
Something like that. Yeah.
Because we stayed up until like 1 a.m. watching it.
I was working nights at the time, so I was up for it. This idea of a lived-in world, and there are so many things that game designers have discovered you can do in order to give that feeling that the world is lived in. You have people, you have signs of people, and this is just kind of the level above that, where there are people, there are signs that people are interacting with stuff. Now you have people actually interacting with stuff, and it's not in a set. I just said set. I don't want to set setup, even though that's basically what I'm trying to say. It's not in an orchestrated design side quest kind of fashion. I'm trying to build this boat to get across the river. It's just random NPC hanging out. Here is random monster hanging out. They come together and they react the way you would expect them to. I love in Tears of the Kingdom, for example, if the moblins or the bokoblins and the robots, the constructs, ever interact with each other, they start fighting because they're not of the same faction. So it makes perfect sense that they would start harassing each other.
Yeah, the whole faction thing, I do wish there was a bit more instances of it. Because I can only think of those few areas on the map where bits of the sky fall down, and that's where the constructs are, like surrounding that. I can only think of like maybe two. I wish more monsters were up in the sky. Obviously, you have to figure out how to explain them getting up there.
They didn't explain how the islands got up there, so you can...
It's
basically just Aracudas that are the only enemies you may fight, aside from constructs.
Yeah. Right? And they die in one hit. So
yeah.
I mean, there's the entirety of the depths too. They don't explain that either. So
yeah,
there's a whole lot that I will have to correct myself. They technically explain how the Sky Islands get up there. That was a joint project between Minoru and Zelda.
Right.
Though they don't explain how Zelda knew that a hero was going to come from the skies, because she would have no idea that Link was going to wake up there. I'm currently at this. I've been doing this in my Tears of the Kingdom playthrough. I just got through collecting all of those memories from the different, from the Chamberlain, the Chambermaiden who wrote them all down, asked Minoru to send them up there, and you can get them translated in Kakariko Village. It's like, wait, so we were just talking about the advantages of vagaries when you. Put it in too much detail, there's a challenge and a chance of you accidentally writing yourself into plot holes.
Well, hopefully Age of Imprisonment gets us some ideas.
I mean, they've already given us who I assume is the woman who wrote all those things.
Right.
Oh, yeah. You know, I didn't even think of that until you just mentioned that. That probably is her.
I think the they officially called her the, I have to check the tweet, the post, but I think they called her the chambermaid.
They gave her a title of some kind. I just don't remember what it is.
Yeah. If those of you listening, obviously we're not saying names because we can't remember names, as we've already established in the, on this podcast. But she is a heavier set woman. She is a bit of a writer herself, I've noticed, because she's carrying a pen and paper.
Oh, yep. Linalia.
That's it.
A chamberlain who attends to Princess Zelda and is one of Raru's most trusted attendants.
Oh, yeah. No, that literally spells out, because in the records, it says that she was assigned as a chamberlain to Zelda. That's fun.
Yeah.
That comes out in less than a month. What the heck?
Yeah. Got a bunch of games I got to finish before then.
I have to pace out. Okay, when am I doing this? Because obviously I'm going to stream it. So it's like, okay, when am I streaming it? I'm in the middle of 100%ing Tears of the Kingdom because I am a shameless completionist. How am I going to do it? That's a whole different discussion. I find it frustrating that if you fail to save Lika, she's mad at you.
These ungrateful NPCs, man.
You didn't die. You were knocked out. But you were saved, even if you weren't conscious for all of it. Be happy that you survived. Even if you don't feel like gifting me something, I'm not expecting a reward. Usually.
There's also random weapons just littered throughout the overworld of Breath of the Wild. So you'd think that she'd just at some point find something to walk around and protect herself with.
In a world where you have already suffered through the apocalypse, it is mind-boggling to me that every single person doesn't have something to defend themselves with. You have come out into the middle of nowhere. You don't even have a village. You are sitting next to a open stable. Every single person who works here, I don't care if you're 8 or what, you need to know how to defend yourself.
Yeah, especially the people at the stables. Like, they gotta have, I think a couple of them, maybe one, have, like, stationed knights or just mercenaries or just people, volunteer soldiers or whatever.
I can't think of a single one of them that does.
Well, up in Akala, next to the research lab, there is one guy with a helmet and a spear.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, I can't think of any more.
Isn't he the guy who runs the one mini game with, like, transporting the blue fire as quickly as possible to and from the lab? Or is that a different NPC? But you're right, there is a soldier station at the Akala Citadel.
Yeah, it is in that specific area. I don't know if that quest is exactly his.
Right.
But
I don't remember that quest at all.
It's like I said, it's a mini game. It's not really a quest. It's just how quickly can you get the blue flame down from the lab to the stable.
Huh. Yeah, just one of these interesting details that... Wait a second.
TLDR... NPCs, get your combat game up. Skill issue.
Seriously. I mean, at least in Tears of the Kingdom, some of them have decided, yeah, we should probably, like...
organize.
Take our land back from literal incarnations of evil.
Some of my favorite side quests in Tears of the Kingdom, by the way.
Those are really fun.
Seeing that shot in that final trailer... of, like, Link crouching with everyone else, even, like, the Goron behind them, just ready to go. That's honestly so cool. Really cool.
I thought we were going to have, like, a whole-on Hyrule Warriors section of the game. Nope, we got a whole nother Hyrule Warriors game in less than a month. Get ready, everybody.
Kind of did at the final battle, the monster forces with all the sages.
Ooh, that's true. Oh, I've been talking about this on my stream as well. I am really frustrated that we didn't have a full-on party of heroes, companions with us the entire time. Can you imagine traveling around Hyrule with all of our friends?
Yeah.
Instead of these weird shadow things?
I think we even talked about that a couple podcasts ago.
We probably have. Because obviously streaming Tears of the Kingdom takes a long, 100%ing Tears of the Kingdom takes a long time.
Yeah.
Am I only doing it like 4 hours a week?
My most wanted Zelda game at this point is like a turn-based RPG that's basically like Super Mario RPG, but with Zelda characters.
A Zelda turn-based RPG has been up there as one of my most wanted concepts for a game.
I would take that over a next 3D game, to be perfectly honest. I think that would be such a fun concept.
I'm thinking more along the lines of like Dragon Age.
Something with a party, like a party of characters.
A party of characters, a party of companions with champions or whatever. I could every time I'm doing it, I'm just like, oh, can you just imagine the banter? Give me the banter between all of these characters. I want Tulin playing pranks, because he seems like he'd be the prankster. Yunobo's the one who would be freaking out the most because of said pranks. Riju is the mom. Sidon is the overzealous, let's go save the world guy. And Link is just like, what do you all want from me?
Character interactions are one of my most driving forces of like any story-based game. I love character interactions between characters that don't usually interact like with each other. Man, so Tears of the Kingdom gave me a little bit of that, a very minute amount of that with the raid on Hyrule Castle when you're fighting Phantom Ganon, and then the sages are talking with each other somewhat. Yes. But that's it. No more.
I want more.
I need more.
Oh. Well, this conversation may have gone a few random directions, but thank you, Caitlin Druitt, for opening up this page of the Bomber's Notebook for us. And we now turn to our feature of the month. And the reason Jeff is here. Jeff, you are actually the one who is in charge of our features section. Are you like the chief editor? What's your official title?
The lead editor.
Lead editor, okay.
Lead editor for the features team, yep.
And I think this setup was your idea of doing something that everyone absolutely loves to do, and that is to make lists.
Oh, yes.
We love countdowns. We love it so much that there are literally websites dedicated to, hey, want to make your own list of things? And for this month, your list involves something that we're all going to want a lot of in the next, well, if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, what you're going to want in the next few months. A lot of heat.
That's right. The 10 most memorable volcanic environments in The Legend of Zelda. The perfect foil to a list I did earlier this year, which was the 10 most memorable wintry environments.
Did you do that one in the summer?
I did not.
Ah, you could have had the summer one in the winter one in the summer and the hot one in the winter. Make us yearn for the temperatures that we don't currently have.
I'm just getting more of it now because it's already hot in Texas. So this is, man.
Actually, the first thing I did when I started looking down the list, it was, okay, what are we missing? Because as iconic as fire levels are, you have 10 listed here, and it's, wait.
Yeah, every time I do a list, there's always one or two honorable mentions that I would love to have included, but just couldn't make the cut.
I would just like to say that I am very grateful that Triforce Heroes is included, because it rarely ever is.
Yeah, and that one's not rare. That one's not common for me because I'm sorry to say I'm not a huge fan of Triforce Heroes, but it had at least one entry on here that I felt was deserving.
Triforce Heroes is a continuation of a concept that Nintendo has tried 3 times now for multiplayer Zelda, and
mixed results.
It's hard to have the kind of adventure that Zelda is known for with other people. We were just talking about how much we want to have a party together, and yet at the same time, there is kind of a reason why we haven't been able to have that. It's a little challenging to have that kind of environment when you have multiple people with you at the same time. I have this issue when I'm running Dungeons and Dragons. I want to set up a dramatic or even a scary environment, and just the sheer fact that you have people with you lightens the load a little bit, especially if you have at least one character who cannot help but crack jokes.
Mm. Kind of breaks the tone.
Want to dive into this list, boys?
Let's do it.
All right.
Let's
so
do
number
it.
Number 10, the aforementioned entry from Triforce Heroes, the Hinox Mine, which is just one part of the volcano section, which I would say is a genuinely good, well-designed part of Triforce Heroes. I'd say that's probably the best design part of Triforce Heroes. But the Hinox Mine in particular got entered on here for all of its minecart nonsense, especially once the Hinox brothers jump on board and you get involved in a gigantic firefight with them, throwing bombs back and forth between one another as your minecarts race down the tracks.
Anytime you have minecarts, you're going to have fun.
I love obligatory minecart sections, especially ones with combat.
Right, it kind of feels like a rail shooter at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Literally.
Number 9 is Turtle Rock from Link's Awakening, to be specific. Yes. Probably the largest 2D dungeon, I think, in the series. I haven't quantified the exact size of every other 2D dungeon, but I know that Turtle Rock in Link's Awakening has 52 rooms, which is got to be up there then as far as the 2D dungeons go.
Definitely up there. I don't think it's the biggest. If I were to give the biggest, it would probably be Sword and Shield Dungeon from Oracle of Seasons.
And that one we could measure, actually, because they are like specifically like, you know, block by block rooms.
Block by, yeah, as the 2D games are wont to be.
Right. So that is something we could do someday. So that could be the case. And you're right. Yeah, Sword and Shield is such a convoluted dungeon.
And it is also at least 50% lava. So there's an honorable mention for you.
Fantastic. Although we do get the oracles mentioned in this list later on.
Yes, we do.
In fact, it's our very next entry.
Ha ha!
Number 8, Subrosia from Oracle of Seasons. I got a little liberal with this one. It's an entire overworld, essentially, that made the list on here.
Well, to be fair, you did not say dungeons, you said environments.
Yes. Gave myself that out.
Good job. What do you guys feel of Subrosia?
It's always been such a... Because I'm gonna be honest right now. The Oracle games are the only two Zelda games I have not beaten.
Well, we appreciate your honesty. We always appreciate that here.
But I have played enough of the games to at least experience and get to Subrosia.
It is only in Seasons.
Well, what's the fireplace in Ages? Because I could have sworn there were Subrosians were in that game.
Subrosia is... There's only one Subrosia who can be in Ages, and that is if you have already played Seasons first and you bring it over, because then their idol with the bow is traveling around.
Yeah, it's just an NPC. You don't actually go to Subrosia in Ages.
There is a lava-themed dungeon. I want to say it is Dungeon 5, because it's in Symmetry City.
It's Gorons. That's what it is. Ages has Gorons.
Correct.
Seasons does too, actually.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
But not too many.
I definitely did not play these games. But I've obviously known that Subrosians exist, and they've always just been such like a weird, funny concept that I just never could wrap my head around the Subrosians.
I feel like Subrosia suffers from the Game Boy Color graphics and technology, because it just seems so bleh. Like I'm fine with a quirky underground civilization that has these odd such and so forth. The characters aren't bad, but the actual environment is, because everything is just red and only red, it's kind of bleh to me.
I did appreciate that they added some like ecological diversity to the lava environment with that. Like you had the full beaches with the coast and the sandy shores. And I don't know if that's water or straight up lava that's lapping against the coastline. Then you have the forest where the trees look just completely alien from being underground. So it at least wasn't just lava and fire. There was some environmental diversity there in Subrosia.
Mm-hmm. It kind of reminds me of I forgot the name again, but it's that underground place in the end of Earthbound, where it's like dinosaur world.
I don't know either. It's been so long since I played Earthbound.
Same.
But it's like an underground, like Hollow Earth kind of thing, where it's dinosaurs, right? And you got volcanoes, you got geysers, and you got like trees and stuff. That's kind of, I feel like Subrosia was kind of meant to be like that sort of, you know, Hollow Earth world biosphere kind of thing. Same thing. I do appreciate that diversity there.
So does that mean that Donkey Kong Bonanza is just an extension of Subrosia, since literally everything is underground and it's
Donkey Kong Bonanza is a new artistic reimagining of Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Yep.
And an awesome, awesome game that everybody should play.
I need to go back to playing it. I have so many other games and stuff that I'm doing. Plus, it became October and I got to stream scary things and yada yada. Anywho.
Probably my game of the year.
Ooh.
Respectable.
Alrighty. Number 7, The Fire Sanctuary from Skyward Sword.
Woo!
Which is gorgeous as far as the architecture goes.
Yes. I am a big fan of the Fire Sanctuary. As soon as you get past the frog water part is probably the most annoying part of this dungeon, at least for me, even though you don't even do it all that much. But beyond that, like the lava hands and all of the, I had a fun time with the Fire Sanctuary just as a dungeon as a whole. It is, and I think because it's so beautiful,
mm-hmm.
It's just cool to look at.
Right, you've got that architecture that's very clearly inspired by like Buddhist temples of Southeast Asia. The roofs are actually shaped like flames. They've got gold and red colorations on there. The spires are shaped like flames. It's really, really beautiful. And then you've got sections where you see other like Southeast Asian motifs, like the lion dogs, where the lava is pouring out of their mouths that create the river then for you that you got to eventually travel over. You have statues of owls. You said the statues of frogs.
Are there frog statues in Southeast Asian?
I mean, frogs are a common creature in a lot of Southeast Asian cultures, but frogs are common in a lot of cultures.
Okay. This is my lack of cultural awareness here. So.
Yeah, big fan of Fire Sanctuary. Probably my... I hesitate to say second favorite dungeon, but it's up there.
We all know what the first one is.
Let's say it on three. One, two, three. Ancient Cistern. Fire Sanctuary is so good. I love the... As you said, the architecture, but just the visual variety. It's not just fire caves, like another entry that we'll get to here soon.
You mean like the rest of them?
Yeah.
No, I know what he means, though, but there's like, there's just a lot of open air sections in the Fire Sanctuary.
Exactly.
Like you don't have a ceiling over you. Like there are sections, obviously, where you're just walking through an enclosed hallway or an enclosed chamber, but there's a lot of just open air walkways, a lot of courtyards where you can see the sky above you. So it does bring a very different aesthetic to the fire environment.
Right. And it diversifies itself from the other technically fire dungeon in the game, earlier in the game.
Number 6, Dragon Roost Cavern in the Wind Waker.
Ah, fun times.
Which I love similarly to why I like the Fire Sanctuary, because there is that section toward the middle where you go out onto the cliffs over Dragon Roost Isle after being locked away inside this you know, magma fire-filled cavern, and you go right back outside to the sun-drenched cliffs over the island. Got the clear sky above you, Valu's roaring nearby.
The thing that I always appreciate about Wind Waker's dungeons is the design of all of them takes into account the fact that you are on islands. So there is absolutely no real, any kind of horizontal weaving that you can do. All of the temples are built vertically.
I had not considered that until just now, but you're absolutely right.
Every single one of them. There's no sprawling dungeon.
Right.
Because there's no sprawling land to build the dungeon on, especially if you include the fact that everything is essentially like just tall mountains that everything is sitting on. And so everything has to be up and down. And that works perfectly for a volcano because that's what a how a volcano is designed. And so being able to manipulate height in this way with fire geysers, the literal volcano itself. And then, of course, we get to have Valu be just the most hilarious tortured lizard you've ever seen.
That poor dragon.
That poor dragon.
Also, some very good puzzles in there for what's the first proper dungeon. Like, obviously, the Forsaken Fortress is the first dungeon-like environment in the Wind Waker. But, like, the first traditional dungeon of Wind Waker is Dragon Roost Cavern. And there's some fairly sophisticated puzzle design in there. I love where you have to cut down like the birdcage like object and ride the bottom of it up along the lava shaft or the lava geysers. I mean,
And I think this might be the first instance of using water
right
on yes. lava in the series, at least.
Definitely.
That was something I specified in my list, is that like one of the recurring themes of the puzzle design in Dragon Roost Cavern is figuring out a way to traverse the lava, whether that's throwing water on it to solidify it, using the grappling hook to swing across gaps. Very, very good dungeon. One of my favorites.
Since Wind Waker was my first game I ever remember ever playing, like as a conscious human,
As opposed to an unconscious human?
Exactly. I've basically like ingrained all of the sound design and the music with the drums, walking outside, the music cutting out, and you just hear Valu roaring. Like, I've ingrained all of that into my brain. So like the atmosphere in the dungeon is really, really good as well.
That is one of the cool things about those dungeons that specifically play with music and sound design. We're in a different location, so the music either changes or it's cut out entirely. I love that.
Number 5, the Earth Temple in Skyward Sword.
Back to Skyward Sword!
Now, the reason why I have that there above the Fire Sanctuary, even though the Fire Sanctuary probably has the better aesthetics and visuals, the one thing I do not like about the Fire Sanctuary is the underground section with the mole mitts. Kind of ugly and just plain, and also the Earth Temple having a unique boss as opposed to just a rematch with Ghirahim.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
It's the only thing really holding back the Fire Sanctuary, but the Earth Temple I'm really fond of as an early dungeon that feels like there's no wasted space whatsoever. It's just one puzzle, or really, more accurately, one platforming section after another. The design of the dungeon isn't really based around like solution-based puzzles as much as it is environmental hazards that you have to very carefully navigate over. Whether that's walking with the giant stone eyeball across the lava, sometimes over very narrow streams of lava, running away from the boulder that runs out of the dragon's mouth, running up the steep incline as bokoblins are dropping rocks on you. There's a lot of just like platforming sections and environmental hazards that you always need to be mindful of. So it makes the dungeon a little bit fast paced. It kind of makes it feel like it's like a Indiana Jones-esque type of temple that you're exploring with just traps and hazards everywhere.
What I love about this dungeon is the primary section of it is so open. yes, there are puzzles that you have to do in a certain order in order to get everything you need to get the bombs and to raise up the platform, but it doesn't feel like you are going from one puzzle to the next puzzle because it is all essentially in the same open area. So you have to just take things as you come across them. Oh, I just happen to go this direction, which means I'm dealing with this puzzle first. I happen to go this direction, so I have to deal with this puzzle next. It feels more natural as opposed to most dungeons where if you're looking at it with a critical eye, you're thinking, okay, who the heck put these puzzles here? What is the point of these puzzles? This is not... Is this just how you worship in ancient Hyrule?
A hallway?
This doesn't make sense.
No, you know, something that I've noticed as like a common through line with some of the best dungeons, in my opinion, are obviously connecting with the core theme, but also having like a central chamber. Some of them, my favorite dungeons have a central chamber, and I love that for some reason. I don't know why. Ancient Cistern has it. Lakebed Temple has it. Almost every dungeon in Twilight Princess has it, kind of, some degree. I don't know why. That's just something that in Earth Temple here, also kind of as you said, Connor has it, and I don't know. It's just a really cool just design structure. Maybe they rely on it too much throughout the series, but.
Well, if you think about it, if we were to look at the nature of temples just as a religious structure, temples tend to have one main central area that is the focus of whatever rituals or worship that they do, and right. Then all of the other rooms are auxiliary in whatever fashion that they have, be they offices or classrooms or whatever it happens to be. And so that feels, that central location always feels a lot more natural than, like I said, just, okay, why do I just have this maze of puzzles? This doesn't feel like a temple.
Right. I never even thought about it like that, but yeah, that's true.
It feels very organic.
Yeah.
Like I said, feels like a temple that Indiana Jones would have dived into. Moving on to number 4, the Goron Mines and Twilight Princess.
Speaking of places that don't look or feel anything like what they're called...
Well, what's interesting about, I feel, with the Goron Mines is, you know, it is a lot, obviously a lava-based temple, but like the most memorable feature of it isn't even lava. It's those magnetic sections where you're walking up and down, you know, in some cases, vertical or upside down surfaces with the iron boots.
Mm-hmm. How do the Gorons travel in this place? They're not magnetic.
I hadn't thought of that.
And they can't jump. Or I guess Dangoro does.
They can roll off ramps, but there are no... As far as dungeon design goes, it's really cool. And once again, we have another section where there's outside areas and inside areas. I love the section where you have all those bokoblins just shooting at you and you have to deal with them. I love having the Hawkeye for that. It is so fun. But... from an actual natural construction standpoint, that this is not how the Gorons would make anything at all.
I want to believe that the idea is that it's like run down. They don't really use it. It's not really in use anymore. Maybe they did before.
Maybe it also got messed up once, you know.
When Fyrus went nuts.
Yeah. I was about to say Dangoro, but that's not him. He's the mini boss in there, mm-hmm. which is a really fun mini boss. And in my opinion, one of the rare cases where the mini boss is better than the dungeon's final boss.
I would agree.
That fight where you got to fight on the platform, like kind of like a sumo fight. You're switching back and forth between the iron boots to stay on and be able to stay mobile so you can attack him is a really, really good mini boss fight.
Big agree.
But just some really, really cool sections in the Goron Mines where whether it's from one of the moving cranes or just the ceiling where you're hanging upside down and you have to go into first or third person view with the bow to shoot enemies, to shoot switches.
That is so dizzying.
Yeah, it's good mechanical puzzle design, but also just like the the visual aesthetic of it is really, really interesting and really unique. Something I can't remember any other dungeon really doing since then.
And I really enjoy those couple of rooms where the color palette completely shifts. So you have like those cool blue water caves that you go to.
Yeah.
That immediate switch, I think I really appreciate that. Where it's not just like every room is a lava tube or anything. And the blue sheen of those magnetic walls that you walk on is really, it spices things up. That's what I'm trying to say.
Number three, the ancient city of Gorandia in Tears of the Kingdom. For my money, the best section of Tears of the Kingdom storyline. Of the four regional phenomena quests, Death Mountain easily has my pick for the best one.
It is really funny to me. People's opinions about the dungeons of Tears of the Kingdom are so polarized. It seems like you either love them or you hate them. I love them, to be clear. I think it's really fun to have, with this setup, expanding on what they were trying to do with the Breath of the Wild and making it feel more temple-y. And Gorandia is... Gorandia is the one that I had to cheese the most. For some reason, the railing got me all kinds of mixed up the first time I played it. I was just climbing walls.
There were a couple bits where I think... And I also really enjoyed... I enjoyed all the dungeons. Even the Water Temple one. I know that's the hot take. But I really enjoyed these. I think Gorandia could have probably benefited from just more walls, I guess. I kind of got spoiled earlier than I would have seen it, because I was in the depths just walking around. Oh, yes. And I was like, oh, what's that underneath the on the Goron City, the Death Mountain section of the map in the depths? Oh, is that the dungeon? Oh man, that's the dungeon. So I wish it was kind of just walled off a bit more.
I agree. The only one that's... Okay, technically, the waterworks are walled off because it's impossible to get up there otherwise, except what it is. The only one that truly feels like that is the Lightning Temple.
Right.
Because you have to specifically activate it to bring it up. And I can definitely see the problem. I was wandering around during my completionism run in the depths and... completely lost because I was specifically trying to just, okay, I'm just going this direction I know, and then eventually I'll go back up to the surface. It's, wait, where am I? Oh, this is near the Spirit Temple. I should not be here.
Yeah. Thankfully, I didn't get spoiled by the I didn't spoil myself for the Spirit Temple, but yeah, for Gorandia, it was unfortunate.
As far as the actual environment is concerned, though, I really love Gorandia's aesthetic.
Right. So, like, Kane, I think it's interesting that you mentioned that how you, like, found Gorandia earlier than anticipated. Part that is actually part of why I enjoy it and had it ranked as high as I did, because I love just how massive and looming it is in the distance. Like, even not even take into account the dungeon itself, just the trek to it, I think, is one of the most exciting parts in Tears of the Kingdom. From the time you dive into the chasm from the center of Death Mountain, it's a really neat case where, even without the light route, you actually have some semblance of light and illumination in the depths. Right. You got the lava cutting through the darkness, you got the haze of like volcanic ash blowing in the air, and then just in the distance, you kind of see these titanic walls looming in the shadows. Almost kind of feels like a Moria vibe from Lord of the Rings. But I absolutely love that, and there really isn't too much involved with it, but I just love that trek that you make with Yunobu from the first light route up to the front gate of the Fire Temple then.
Yeah,
I think it's one of the best instances of scale in Tears of the Kingdom. Only beaten out by the climb to the Wind Temple with right. Tulin.
And I do really like that prelude to the Fire Temple here. and just how it's organized. You're basically zigzagging up this hill to, like, you just see the majesty that is the Fire Temple, Las Garandia. And the architecture, like, hanging from the ceiling as well, it's so creative in that sense. I really enjoyed it. And they have minecarts.
That too.
Yay, minecarts!
It's peak.
And if you don't like the minecarts because they are a little confusing, you can just skip over them if you like. The Fire Temple's pretty open-ended in that respect.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about the music.
Oh, sure.
Because I'm a big music guy. And at any opportunity I will talk about the music. I've been holding it in this entire time. I wanted to talk about the Fire Sanctuary.
I'm so annoyed there wasn't a Medley's Melody this month, because...
Man, I could talk about Zelda music all day. But with the Tears of the Kingdom dungeons, specifically the dungeons, once you flesh out all of the locks, where you get all the mechanisms taken care of to unlock the boss, the complete version of the dungeon themes use the champion themes from Breath of the Wild in the dungeon theme themselves. So you can hear Daruk, the champion, in the Fire Temple, which I really, really, really enjoy. And then the boss themes utilize that dungeon's sage as well as that region's village. So in Marbled Goma, there's Yunobo's theme and Goron City. Same thing for Rito Village. Obviously the Kolgara fight. We all know the Kolgara fight.
That music is incredible.
It's immaculate. That uses Rito Village and a bit of Tulin's theme, and then the same thing for Riju and Queen Goma.
Gibdo.
Queen Gibdo.
So many queens in this franchise.
A lot of queens. Love to see
See, that's why it's not Queen Zelda. It's Princess Zelda, because there are too many queens that are villains.
Yeah. There you go.
We've solved the riddle.
I will say, my one gripe with the dungeons... Not my one gripe. I have a couple of gripes. But something that kind of just irks me is the names. I feel like they could have been called anything other than temples.
Only one of them is actually a temple.
The Lightning Temple.
Yeah.
Like, you could have called the Water Temple the Great Wellspring. You could have called the Wind Temple the Stormwind Arc. Like,
and technically they do, but for some reason they had to put it in there as they're not, yeah. Wind Temple, Stormwind Arc.
It's like a title, not a name.
I wonder whose decision that is. We would have to have someone who knows the Japanese version. What do they refer these as, if they're not, are they referred to as temples in the original, or is that just a naming convention that they decided to just hang on to because that's what we're familiar with?
Yeah, maybe like the primary name or the primary way it's referred to. Mm-hmm. It is like Stormwind Art, Garandia. Be interesting to look up. Gonna move on.
Number two,
the Fire Temple in Ocarina of Time. If I'm being perfectly honest, this would be my personal favorite entry on the list. I couldn't put it number one, because that wouldn't be fair, especially to what number one is, but the Fire Temple is probably my favorite of any environment on here.
It's your list. You could have made it number one if you wanted.
Yeah, but I gotta be objective with this. I adore the Fire Temple in Ocarina of Time. If it wasn't for the Forest Temple, it would maybe be my favorite temple in the whole series.
Really?
I'm a huge fan of it. I love the aesthetic because it's a fire temple that kind of feels creepy. And honestly, I almost feel like it feels creepier than the Shadow Temple, because where the Shadow Temple is just really dark and grimy, the Fire Temple feels very foreboding. No matter which music track you have, whether it's the music track from the gold cartridge and first gray cartridge of Ocarina of Time, or the music that they change later, it's very creepy, very unsettling music. There's just this constant, like, eerie ambiance in the Fire Temple, partially because you're not just grabbing keys and solving puzzles, you're saving the Gorons one by one throughout it. You know, it's not like necessarily a temple of worship. It almost feels like a temple of sacrifice, because the Gorons are imprisoned there to be sacrificed to Volvagia.
I had such a fun time designing the revamped story for this part of the game that turned from what we had into like an orchestrated, designed rescue operation and resistance movement with both Link and Darunia diving through the fire temple, causing like a distraction while Darunia's son rallied the Gorons to make like a full on prison break scene. It was so much fun to do this as we're going around. We give the Water Temple a lot of flack for being a mess and never having the right key to get what we need. The Fire Temple has the most keys of any dungeon. And some of them are really annoying to get.
I didn't know that.
There's eight of them. There are eight keys in this dungeon.
That kind of makes sense because you need keys to get all of the Gorons, right?
No.
The Gorons give you a key, I think, in each cell.
Essentially, there's a key in every chest in every Goron cell.
Okay.
Huh. Play randomizers enough and you suddenly realize, oh no, this dungeon isn't anywhere near as bad as you think it is.
I never thought of that, yeah. If you've got a bazillion chests, I'll bet that's a real pain in the butt for a randomizer.
It's a give and take, because on the one hand, yes, there's so many places to check, but they're also all in the same place. So, for example, Bottom of the Well is an awesome place because there are so many chests.
Right.
That means you're almost guaranteed at least something of import is going to be there.
I'm looking at a 3D diorama of the map of the Fire Temple, and I'm honestly surprised. There's only three, technically four if you count the boss, rooms that have lava.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that it's not using the just slapping lava in every room, every floor is lava. It's using fire in other ways, which I like.
And there's just this like ever-present veil, like fiery veil. Like the air looks like it's orange naturally. Like, mm-hmm. like everything, there's kind of the colors are distorted just because like the heat is so intense in every room.
I do like the color scheme of like the yellow, architecture of the walls, the patterns and designs. It does give it a unique identity amongst the rest of the dungeons in the game, and it's even amongst fire dungeons in the series. I don't know why, because it's all just yellow and red. But for some reason it works. Like I can't really explain it.
There's also something really fascinating about diving into a dungeon or a temple that's ostensibly meant to be a place of worship, but one that, especially in real life, we could never visit. Like in real life, we could build a big old temple in the middle of a forest, but we could never actually go into the middle of an active volcano. So that's like a fantastical element that's only possible in a video game.
Mm-hmm.
Because unfortunately, Goron tunics and fireproof elixirs are not real things in real life.
Not with that attitude.
I suppose.
I think we do have heat-resistant material.
But sure, but...
We're not walking through lava anytime soon.
It's that big old hazmat suit of white and reflective such and such. Can't look anywhere near as fashionable in those things.
Nah.
Listen, in a video game, if Link falls into a pool of lava, he just has a quick death animation and then automatically respawns with, like, losing a heart. In real life, it's a little bit more dire.
Mm-hmm.
Righty, want to get to the number one? Top pick on this list?
I think it's trying.
Roll! I don't know if you could hear that.
It's a very big one, so again, we're being a little liberal with this, but the Elden region in Breath of the Wild. If you ever wanted to explore a volcanic environment that is as large as the entire overworld of other Zelda games, this was your opportunity.
The floor is literally lava.
One part of Breath of the Wild's massive overworld, all the lava and volcanic ecosystems and environments that you could ask for. Which also has one of my favorite things, which are hot springs.
Yeah.
Ah, we love a good hot spring.
And in contrast to the lava, which is obviously very deadly, is able to heal your hearts if you're missing any while relaxing inside them. So I love that little bit of ecological contrast there between the hot springs and the lava.
The amount of realistic environment is, of course, a little hit or miss, but I love when a Zelda world feels a little bit more quote-unquote realistic. Now, I am not a environmentalist, geologist, or whatever, so I could not tell you how true to life Hyrule's environmental structure is. I kind of question some of it, but it's fun to see these little relationships that make sense. Hot springs come primarily because of underground lava, so of course, this is a place where you would probably be finding hot springs.
Actually, it's called magma.
That's true. I've been wondering that this whole time, if we were saying that
correctly. If it's underground, it's magma.
That's right. That is true.
Sorry, here, let me put on my glasses.
There you go. You gotta push them up real quick.
Yeah, there you go. Push up the bridge of the nose.
Actually. With the Elden region, I enjoy it because it's so visually different as opposed to the majority of the rest of Hyrule, which is grasslands and trees. You have a couple of spots here and there, but generally it's just green. But with the Elden region, with Death Mountain, having to maneuver and navigate in different ways than what you've been doing the entire game or everywhere else in the entire game, I think it's very cool and it adds a different challenge. I think it gets even more expanded in Tears of the Kingdom, but they take out the lava. We're talking about Breath of the Wild, though, so I'll go back to that.
When have we been sticking to one location this whole podcast? It's been almost 90 minutes. We've yet to stay on one topic.
It's the same place. We'll go with it. What Tears of the Kingdom does when they take out the lava is they reveal all the stuff that was beneath it. So you have all these new caves and stuff to explore. And I guess less platforming challenge, but more, I guess, underground challenges, because that's where the lava is now. Sorry, magma.
Already messed up.
And something that I'm you guys might know, it's not really a super hidden fact, but the overworld music changes here and it becomes the actual Death Mountain theme from Zelda 1, but it's more sparse and on piano. Boom, right. Boom, boom, boom.
Yes. Yep. I'm hearing it now in my head now that you mentioned it. You're right. Because nice. Other parts of Breath of the Wild's overworld is just, you get the ambiance of nature, maybe that quick piano tune, but you're right. There is a constant musical note going on in Death Mountain.
I have to pay attention next time I go by.
Have you guys played the Champion's Ballad DLC?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, of course.
In Breath of the Wild. Okay. I don't know about you, but one of my favorite parts of the entire game, DLC or base, is that section where you hang glide and following the rings along the slopes of Death Mountain. Again, that is such a great moment of scale and scope that you're flying down the side of this titanic mountain that we had not gotten in another Zelda game prior.
Has it ever occurred to you, these games are big?
And then by that same token, like, while you're completing Valrudania, at any point where you can just go outside and stand on top of it and look around, the sweeping visual of standing in the middle of an active volcano is just breathtaking. It is such a stunning, arresting sight.
Mm-hmm.
So I currently live in Tacoma, Washington, and the most prominent feature of this area, if I go outside and I get a nice, good, clear view of southeast of here, I see Mount Rainier. And I'm like, oh, yes, this is such a beautiful place that I live in. Oh, right. That's an active volcano. I had a neighborhood meeting at the beginning of this week, and we had emergency management there. And one of the things we were talking about is, this is what you should be prepared for should that thing decide to go off. Oh, and by the way, it's kind of due to erupt sometime in the somewhat near future.
When was the last time it erupted?
Oh, it's been a while. It's supposed to go off every couple hundred years or so.
Oh, that's fun.
And it's around that time at this point.
Well, I hope you got a Goron tunic handy.
I hope I do. I will need to. I'll go talk to Darunia, see what he can do for me.
Some firebreaker armor.
Clang, 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 clang.
One thing I wanted to also talk about, now that we're at the end, the bottom of the list, I guess technically the top.
Descending order.
the list has concluded.
Yes. Something that kind of ties everything together. The music. Always back to the music.
Amazing!
Kaden not talking about music challenge level impossible.
How dare you talk about your life?
I know, right? One of the biggest things that connects these, any themed area in any game, it's usually the music. Instruments that are used, rhythmic patterns, tempos, anything. And a common thing, I don't know for sure what Subroge's music sounds like. Also, it's on Game Boy, so that sound font is kind of rough. I can't recall.
That's by that example,
it's very heavy. Bum, ba-dum, bum,
yes,
bum.
Very
it's
much.
Not particularly upbeat, right?
Right. I can't recall Turtle Rock's music, but at least for the rest of the examples, a really common thing that you hear, especially with the Goron areas, is you got low register marimba and brass, low brass, very heavy music. Bum, bum, ba-dum, bum. It's very, very deep and very growly, and specifically with the marimba.
It's like a mountain.
Yeah, exactly. And fire areas, it's something that I'm, honestly, in my own personal composition journey, I'm trying to like figure out how I want to approach it. And I'm referencing Zelda for a lot of these, because even across these series, in other series, other franchises and other companies use very common techniques for composing music for fire areas. And Garandia is probably my favorite example out of all of these listed. Just because also it uses Daruk's motif, and I love Daruk so much. But it just fits so well. Yunobo's theme, amazing. I love it so much. And yeah, I just wanted to mention that because it's kind of like a through line through all of these games. Even if they don't exactly match instruments 100% of the time, they do match in sort of like vibes and spirit.
The ability of music to reflect emotions, environments. There's a reason that we use it in so many things. Movies, TV shows, games.
Mm-hmm. And
it's an interesting argument that we could probably discuss at some point as to what came first, the music or the environment. Like, do we play this music because it's fire, or is it fire and so this is the music we play?
It's all fire. Temple.
It's hot.
Question for y'all. What are some honorable mentions that we might want to just pop on the end of this that weren't included?
The Sword and Shield maze is a fair one in there, just because that is such a sprawling, gigantic dungeon.
Place is massive.
Yeah, that also juxtaposes the themes of fire and ice really well.
Minish Cap's The Mines there, also another place with some excellent minecart sections.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to go with Elden Temple from Echoes of Wisdom.
Agreed.
Oh, yeah.
I was just about to say, I would say that because just purely because of the Volvagia fight. That is such a good boss fight. Maybe my favorite from Echoes of Wisdom. Probably Null would be the only one I would say is better than that. But no, that Volvagia fight is so much fun.
Very good. Sorry, to mention music one more time before we end this. The couple of layers to this one. The Elden Temple music, for anyone listening to this, I would like you to search up I believe it's Carmen Burana? Habanera. Habanera, Carmen. The Elden Temple music uses a very similar instrument and rhythmic pattern to a song created for an opera that is like very fiery passion.
Oh, like literally Carmen? That?
Yes, Carmen.
That opera?
Yes.
Okay.
Or maybe it's not Carmen. Maybe it's Roxanne, Tango de Roxanne. Oh, I forgot. I forgot the exact one. I'm rambling right now.
What do you think we've been doing for the last 95 minutes?
When I get to music, I just snowball. It's but it's very clearly taken inspiration from something that is very also clearly connected to fire and passion, and it's intense. And I just love that so much. It's probably my favorite fire dungeon theme in the series now, Echoes of Wisdom.
Isn't that why, like, the Bolero of Fire is the name for
exactly.
The Fire Temple in Ocarina of Time?
Bolero!
Mm-hmm.
Bolero, it's a Latin inspired, it's a Latin dance. It's a Latin dance, but it's also a Latin style music. And it's tied to Latin fire and passion. So
very energetic.
Exactly. And it uses, the Bolero of Fire uses the same snare drum pattern as the actual Bolero song.
Nice.
Jump, ba-ba-ba-bum, ba-ba-ba-bum, bum, bum.
I learned so much about music that I was not expecting to prior to this podcast.
This is what happens when you bring Caden in.
Music education is my career. So I will, if I could make an entire new channel about video game music, I would, but I don't have the time for that, unfortunately.
Well, we still appreciate you coming and talking music on here, Caden.
Oh, yeah.
And thank you, Jeff, for your features article this time around.
My pleasure.
And thanks to all of our contributors this time around. Aaron Taylor and Brian Washabaugh, Caitlin Druitt, for contributing your columns this month. And thanks to all of you for joining with us on the Zelda Universe podcast. We do this podcast once a month as we come and talk about all of the wonderful things that we love about the Legend of Zelda franchise. Thanks for joining us. Have yourselves a wonderful rest of your day. And we'll see you next time.